Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. The aggravated murder case against the man accused of killing Charlie Kirk will move to trial. The Trump administration is one step closer to repealing the roadless rule. Here's what that means for Utah. And Google inks a massive Utah geothermal deal to power a potential data center. Joining me today later in the program will be investigative reporter Jessica Schreifels. We'll also be joined later in the program by water and land use reporter Leah Larson. Right now we have with us reporter Brooke Larson. Brooke, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the roadless rule. Big news, of course, for much of Utah. First of all, tell us what the roadless rule is.
Yeah, so it was a rule that was established in 2001 that basically, set aside a portion of national forest lands as roadless areas, you know, largely areas that didn't have a, you know, ton of roads in them already. And this was just the Forest Service already dealing or foreseeing maintenance issues with the roads that did exist. So this rule prevents logging and road construction in these roadless areas. There's some exceptions for things like, you know, safety needs or, you know, some wildfire prevention work, things like that. That rule has been in place since 2001, and now the Trump administration is looking to repeal that.
Several things will be affected by this. First of all, what are environmental groups saying?
Yeah, I mean, environmental groups are largely opposed to this, saying this could, you know, harm the ecosystem, wildlife. There's quite a lot of research out there that roads can be disruptive to wildlife, you know, fragmenting habitat, adding stress, things like that. There's also concerns about how this could affect watersheds, damaging water quality, things like that. So environmental groups, for the most part, at least what I've seen, are opposed to this.
Now, Utah's elected leaders, I believe, are in favor.
Yeah, for the most part, Governor Cox has come out, you know, praising this decision, standing behind it. And Utah for a while has, you know, supported repealing the roadless rule or wanting a Utah-specific rule that allowed the state to more what it calls proactively manage the forest. So Utah, the congressional delegation and the governor are in support of this.
The Forest Service says that even if this is repealed, there probably won't be new roads imminently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found that interesting. So the Forest Service, you know, the Trump administration last summer first announced their intent to rescind this rule, but it's a pretty long administrative process to be able to do that. And so just this, a couple weeks ago now, released what's called a draft environmental impact statement. It's basically one of the documents they have to do to analyze the potential effect of, you know, changing this rule or repealing it. And in that document, the Forest Service actually outlined, a lot of basically the financial issues the Forest Service already has maintaining roads. There's a significant backlog in just maintenance needs, a $7 billion backlog about. And so, unless the Forest Service gets significantly more funding, they basically said it's unlikely they will then have the funds to be building a bunch of new roads or like new campground infrastructure or things like that.
One thing that's being debated on this, not settled, is definitely disputed, is if you build more roads into these areas, would that cause more wildfires or would it help to mitigate them and fight them?
Yeah, I mean, that has been The argument of the state and the federal government has been that, like, this roadless rule has caused issues within our forests that have led to some of these extreme wildfires we've seen in recent years, and thus repealing it will help solve this problem. The research shows it's a bit more complicated. I mean, yes, roads can help suppress fires, but also more fires start near roads because most wildfires, in Utah and the West and the country are caused by humans, whether that's campfires that get out of control or, trailer chains dragging or things like that, or just various ways humans cause fires, unfortunately. So, basically, what I have heard from scientists is that repealing this likely won't solve, the wildfire issues we have in Utah and the West, especially because most roadless areas are very remote. I mean, some more so than others. Some are getting closer to human, development as we build closer and, what's known as this wildland urban interface. But the areas that really tend to be high priority places for firefighters to defend against are near human infrastructure, and there's less of that in roadless areas. So, one thing that one researcher said to me is, like, we should be putting our we already don't have enough resources to defend, human infrastructure near roads. So maybe the priority should first be there rather than building new roads into roadless areas. Another thing on the wildfire front is just, people talk about mitigation work like prescribed burning or thinning, and prescribed burning is allowed in roadless areas. Mechanical thinning, a little more challenging to do, but in some instances, possible. One thing I've heard is that yes, repealing this may make some of those areas more accessible, but also a lot of these areas that, in Utah are really steep terrain that's just like pretty difficult to even build roads in or do these operations. So it's a little hard to predict how much of a difference this will make.
Do we think there'd be more logging if these roads or if the roadless rules were repealed?
I mean, I think that is what is expected. That, again, somewhat depends on the economics. Utah does not have like a major logging industry like, the Pacific Northwest. So I think it's a bit uncertain at this point what that would actually look like in Utah. And again, it's going to need to be like make financial sense with the cost of building roads into these areas. But logging is, expected to increase a bit. The numbers I saw in the analysis weren't like dramatic, but it is expected to increase somewhat. And the agency predicts that it could receive another like $5.2 to $11.4 million annually in revenue from those logging activities. So, it's not like dramatic compared to when we see that the backlog in maintenance cost is $7 billion. But there is expected to be, some increase in logging.
What about recreation? Do we think that's going to be harmed or enhanced?
Yeah, I mean, their analysis for the most part said that, this could harm particularly recreation like hiking or other more like backcountry experiences that people tend to seek out in what's currently roadless areas. groups like Trout Unlimited or Backcountry Hunters and Anglers or Save Our Canyons here in Utah have spoken out about concerns to like hunting, fishing, skiing, hiking, recreation activities like that. And the Forest Service did estimate that like if these areas are impaired for these recreation activities, that visitor spending in communities around national forests may drop around $9 million. But then there's also like motorized recreation groups like the Blue Ribbon Coalition, who support this repeal and say that it might, open more like public access. So there's some mixed feelings around that.
So if the roadless rule is repealed, there obviously might be road construction, could have logging. What effect could that have on wildlife?
Yeah, so I kind of mentioned this earlier. One of the main effects is, fragmented habitat, which then can lead to like diverse, like drops in genetic diversity. If you have these smaller populations that are kind of segmented, it can lead to more deaths, more roadkill, lower reproduction rates if these animals are stressed. It could also introduce invasive species, which then could, lead to more costs on the Forest Service to like treat and deal with those invasive species. And the Center for Biological Diversity identified around 400 different plants and animals that are listed as threatened or endangered under the Endangered Species Act that may be affected by this. And that includes some in Utah, like wolverines or the Mexican spotted owl. So wildlife could be affected by this, mostly just roads, yeah, fragment habitat and can lead to stress for animals.
Last section of your story, Brooke, you talk about water. Are there any concerns about water availability, water quality?
Yeah, so most roadless areas are like the, a lot of these roadless areas, at least I should say, are headwaters of various watersheds across the West, including in Utah. We have these roadless areas high up in the Wasatch Mountains, the Uinta Mountains, even the Pine Valley Mountains in southwest Utah near St. George. And water that flows through these roadless areas or snow melt, in these high mountain areas eventually, feeds creeks and streams and rivers that end up in our taps or, watering our farms. And so there is concern that if there's logging in these areas or road building, that that could harm these watersheds. How it could is just there could be like increased sediment in these waterways. If trees are removed, that could lead to like quicker snow melt runoff in the spring. And we know we're already kind of dealing with that with these like abnormally hot springs we've been having. So it is a concern just like alongside, the existing water issues we're already having in Utah.
All right, thanks for telling us about this. I guess one more thing, Brooke. Where are we with this? We're at the environmental impact statement stage. Where are we?
Yeah, so we are in the middle of a public comment period on that. So it is open for comment until September 21st. And in our story, we provide a link to that where people can share with the Forest Service what they think about this. And then after that, the Forest Service will put together a final environmental impact statement and then eventually what's called a record of decision, which is sort of the final say on what will happen.
All right, thank you. We have just a couple minutes here. I want to move to another story of Brooke Larson's. Trump's move to slash Utah National Monument sparks lawsuits from Patagonia and environmental groups. So these are, I guess, new but renewed. There was an effort in Trump number one, right? And then Biden came in. This is kind of a product of this back and forth nature of this.
Yeah, exactly. So these were what's called like supplemental complaints that were filed. Basically, the lawsuits that were filed after Trump previously shrank the monuments in 2017 were put on like an administrative pause once Joe Biden restored and expanded the boundaries in 2021. So what was filed earlier this week is asking the court to reopen those lawsuits. So they're wanting to challenge both the 2017 and the more recent 2026 proclamations from Trump that shrank these monuments.
So, I guess at the heart of this is the Antiquities Act, competing views on what the president can and cannot do with the Antiquities Act.
Yep. So the groups that are suing, which there's a lot, including Patagonia, some tribal-led groups like Utah Dene Bekea, and then a bunch of different environmental groups have a lawsuit as well, like Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. And their claim is that the Antiquities Act just gives the president authority to designate national monuments, not to shrink or revoke them. So that is their argument in the lawsuit.
All right, we'll see how it goes. I'm sure you'll be reporting on this. Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brooke Larson, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
After a break, we're going to be talking with water and land use reporter Leah Larson. Here's the headline. Google inks a massive Utah geothermal deal to power a potential data center. You are listening Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. More following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We bring in next Salt Lake Tribune water and land use reporter Leah Larson. Leah, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. So we want to talk about geothermal and how that relates to data centers here. The headline, Google inks a massive Utah geothermal deal to power a potential data center. I want to take us back to the basics. I was thinking this morning, we're going to be talking about this. I don't know if I know how geothermal works. So maybe you could give us a primer.
Well, I don't. That might be the case for both of us, but
Okay.
I'll do my
All
best.
right.
I think there's traditional geothermal that use steam, kind of like gas and coal plants use steam. I think what Fervo's doing is they use like water, but they recirculate the water, but they just use water to drive heat out of like these deep rock formations far, far below ground. So they somehow use water to move that up from the ground, and then they capture the heat and capture the water and resend the water back down. So that is the
Okay,
best I can explain
very good. Well,
it.
it's more than I knew, and
Great
so
idea for a future
you,
story, Tom.
very good. Yeah, I'll suggest that. Maybe we'll do a whole program on that. So presumably these are the hot spots, or this is the heat from the earth, and that we're using that to heat this in this case, I guess, water. So Fervo, this company, they have a geothermal plant, obviously, and they're now, what, selling that electricity or promising to sell that electricity to Google?
Yeah, so this is like their first big splashy news after they started building that plant out there in 2023. They have officially signed a power purchase agreement with the mega tech giant Google to start sending them about 400 megawatts from this site in Utah that they call Cape Station. They're going to start setting 400 megawatts by 2028, and then they'll give the company an option to buy another 600 megawatts by 2030. So if you think from like shovels in the ground in 2023 till they're already providing power by 2028, that's pretty remarkable for a power plant.
That's about a gigawatt, or right?
Combined, yeah, by
Yeah.
2030, they're offering Google about a gigawatt, which is no small amount of energy or
Right. That
electricity.
that's like a pretty significant portion of the entire electricity Utah uses.
Yeah, the entire state of Utah uses about 4 gigawatts, so this is a quarter of that coming from one single plant. Pretty phenomenal.
Now, this could, if I put on my data center owning mogul hat, this could eliminate or lessen one of the arguments against data centers if you're getting it from renewable energy, this power.
I think so. When people hear about data centers, I think they dredge up a lot of concerns. One is how much water they are going to use. One is how much noise are they going to create for my neighborhood. But another big one is how much energy they're going to consume. And the legislature, in its wisdom, a few years ago passed a bill that allowed big energy hogs like data centers to just build their own power plants. And a lot of chosen to do that rather than trying to tap into like the grid that you and I use for our homes and for our businesses. These data centers instead are just building their own power plants. But what they've looked to do that is natural gas. And so they're either buying up a whole bunch of generators and just firing them off 24/7, connecting them to a gas pipeline, or they are, in the case of like the controversial Wonder Valley data center up by Box Elder County, that one wanted to build like an entire traditional gas plant at some point. So that's what they're doing. But of course, the problem with natural gas is, despite the name, natural, you think it's all green and environmentally friendly. And it's true that it's better than traditional sources like coal, but it is almost entirely made out of methane, which is a potent greenhouse gas. And also, when you burn it, you have like these like secondary materials that you create that are contributing to like our ozone pollution in the summer and our smog pollution in the winter during inversions. So they had some renewable advocates concerned that all these data centers are turning toward natural gas. But in this case, Google's looking at geothermal, which doesn't have those emissions.
One expert you talked to said in the data, I'll just quote this, the data center world, speed to power is a precious commodity. This, I guess, comparatively would be pretty fast to bring this power on board.
I mean, I think that's this fascinating thing that's happened with the rise of artificial intelligence and these data centers being planned all over the place, despite community protests, is that they're having a hard time getting the energy they need and deployed fast enough. So a lot of people have talked about, well, we'll just build these mini little nuclear plants called small modular reactors. I know the state of Utah is pretty excited about those, but those take like a long time to come online, to get permitted, to get built. In fact, I don't even think there's a single operational SMR in the United States yet to this day. I think the military uses them a little bit, but I don't think there's one for commercial electricity production. My understanding is they take at least 7 years. And then, we were talking about the natural gas plants. Like some data centers want to build either natural gas plants or use a bunch of generators. And there's like a very long backlog to even get the equipment to do that. I think that's at least 5 to 7 years out just to get the equipment purchased, let alone build the thing. So what Fervo is pulling off here is pretty remarkable, and I'm sure it's caught the attention of a lot of data center investors and developers, I would assume.
So this data center that Google is proposing, is it already up? Is it just proposed? Is it approved?
Oh no. And that is a big gaping question that I have is where's this Google data center going to be? Is it going to be in Beaver County or where Fervo is? We know that they bought a bunch of land near Eagle Mountain where the Meta data center is back in 2021, but they haven't been able to break ground or build anything out there, citing they can't access the energy they need. However, the kind of limiting factor there is the transmission. Like, if they're going to move 1 giga or one, 1 gigawatt of energy from this plant in Beaver all the way up to Eagle Mountain, like, how are they going to get it there? We don't have the transmission capacity, as far as I know. So I did ask Fervo about that, and they never got back to me. So yeah, I don't know where this data center is going to be, and maybe neither do they.
All right. Well, thanks for telling us about this. I'd like to move to a story. This is from last week. It was fascinating. Here's the headline: Utah's mountains may be hiding 1 billion tons of ice. That could be a
Yeah,
boon,
isn't that cool?
presumably. Yeah. So we're talking about rock glaciers. What I learned about what rock glacier is from your story. What is it?
Yeah, I'm glad it's not just me. I also wasn't aware that we had glaciers up in our mountains in Utah. I figured they all melted out when the ice age ended, but no, we've got a lot. We've got a lot throughout the West. You just can't see them because they're covered by this shell of ice. But they're still glaciers. They just formed after the ice age and are protected by this rock layer. And they're all over the Wasatch, and they're even in the LaSalle Mountains near Moab and in the Uinta Mountains.
So, we're, I guess, estimating could be 1 billion tons of ice in Utah.
Yeah, I think collectively, if you're, able to calculate how many glaciers there are, how deep they are, which is what these scientists are kind of setting up to do, yeah, about a billion. I mean, I don't know if it's accessible for us to melt and start, using to feed our cities, but there's a lot of ice stored up there in the mountains.
And those of us who are outdoors people have maybe been walking right over these, not realizing they're there because they're under rock.
Yeah, I mean, the one I focused on for this story is at Mount Tipinogos, which is not an easy hike, but it is very popular, and there is a glacier right there. And if you're looking up there, you might assume like the snowfield that hangs around is a glacier, but no, it's actually under just a pile of essentially gravel. You can't see it, but it's there. You may, like you said, just be walking right over it.
So these rock glaciers understand form after rocks collapse, kind of cover over snowfields, and then a glacier forms.
Yeah, so this is my understanding. So it snows, and then our mountains are very, very steep and active here. So there will be a rock slide, a rock collapse. It will land on top of the snow, and then during the summer it never melts out, or maybe it melts a little, but then it trickles between the rocks and finds the rest of the ice below and reforms. And over time, you have a glacier with a bunch of rock on top.
Tell me about how scientists are measuring this ice. Pretty fascinating science.
Well, I think so. First, they have to find it because if they're hidden, they're not exactly easy to spot. But these guys know what to look for in the landscape. So they've been looking for aerial images, and they say it kind of looks like honey on the landscape. So first, they find them, and then they're able just to do these measurements to see how deep it is. And then they calculate how fast it's moving, and from there they're kind of able to like use math that I don't understand to like estimate how much ice is completely within the Great Glacier. And so they're able to take those calculations and apply them to other glaciers throughout throughout the state, and that's how they came up with like the billion tons of ice throughout the state. That's how they were able to calculate all that. So it's kind of a method of like, how big is it? How fast is it moving? And from there, they're able to figure out how thick it is. And that's how they calculated it. It's pretty impressive.
So one reason people, or at least some people, are excited about this is, well, here's some, we're in an arid state, we're getting more dry, and here's some water. Do we know 1 billion tons? That's kind of, it's beyond my comprehension. What do, can we translate that to acre feet, and how much that, if we could get all that water, what would that do?
Yeah, so it's about 815,000 acre feet of water, which could support up to 1.6 million households, like basic needs indoors. So that, it is a lot of water, like we said at the top. But again, it's locked up in pretty remote places throughout the state, very high up under rocks. So transporting it for like human consumption would not exactly be easy. But I think, what I would say, and what these scientists have told me, is that, it's good to at least be aware of what our water resources are in the state, because we are constantly running into shortages. And I think it just helps with planning. It's just good to know.
Yeah, so I guess yet to be determined if all that water could be extracted, I guess we'll put it that way, and used.
Yeah, if it could, and if it should.
Right.
We just heard about that unstable glacier in Nepal that caused a lot of damage and fatalities. So I don't know if we want to be tinkering with glaciers too much, but I think it is good. It's just useful for water planning purposes. And not only that, it's good that these things are there. They're supporting these like delicate alpine environments, providing water to like certain plant and animal species and aquatic species. They help create these microclimates that keep things nice and cool as our planet kind of cooks due to climate change. So they provide value just beyond like a potential source of water for people, I would say.
I think we have time for just one more story. I was fascinated by this one. Hopefully you're still up on this, Leah. It's about Pine View
No
Reservoir.
promises.
Let me,
Oh,
yeah.
yeah. We can talk about
And
Pine View.
this is, here's the headline. A popular Utah reservoir hits its lowest point in 50 years. It's about to drop even lower. That's because they're going to drain it. And one official in your story says, I don't know if that's a good idea. That quote struck me. So tell me about this.
Yeah, so Pine View Reservoir up where I'm at. Yes, like you said, it's being drained to about 2% of its capacity, which it should hit probably here in a week or so. So it's even lower than it was when I wrote this story on August 23rd. But yes, it's being drained because Ogden City needs to replace some really old pipeline infrastructure that supplies its residents with drinking water. And they've been needing to do this a while. The pipe is very leaky. So they got all this federal funding, and the time has come. And I think they were actually going to do this, a year or two out. But with this really lackluster winter we had, if you could even call it a winter, and no snow, they're like, "Well, the reservoir is low anyway, so let's just finish draining it. Now's the time." Which is, I guess, a compelling argument. But Weber Basin Water Conservancy District, which manages Pine View and a bunch of other reservoirs on the Weber, are pretty stressed out about this. They're pretty stressed out. Like, if we are to get another winter this year, coming year, like we had last year, that is not going to be good for our water supplies, regardless. But if you can't store water in Pine View now to plan ahead, I think it just really has them quite stressed out.
And I think this is in the contract, right? Every 7 years you could drain it, but they haven't done it for quite a while.
Right. Yeah, they reached this agreement with Ogden City decades and decades ago, probably when Ogden was the only city up in this part of the state. Everything else was farmland, right? And farmland's a lot more flexible, where you could every 7 years be like, "Sorry, there's no water in the reservoir." Well, now that those water needs are a bit more firmed up, that we have suburbs and growing cities and things, so Weber Basin said that they really would like to renegotiate this agreement with Ogden City and make this like Ogden City hasn't been draining the reservoir every 7 years, thank goodness. This is the first time they've done it since the 70s. But I don't think Weber Basin likes that they're able to trigger this clause in the contract when they need to. So I think they're renegotiating.
And there's a macabre note, when you drain a reservoir, sometimes you find bodies and such.
I know. Yeah, we've heard those. I mean, Brooke could probably talk about this, but Lake Powell, they find bodies. Meet Lake Mead, they've been finding bodies. But I guess we don't really have a mafia up here in Weber
So no
County
bodies
because they
so
haven't
far.
found any.
Yeah.
Yeah, they haven't found anything of note so far.
Right. Well, thanks for telling us about these stories. Leah Larson, the water and land use reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet.
Well, we have an interview at the end of the program that I recorded yesterday with investigative reporter Jessica Schreifels. Time now for the underplayed stories of the week. Brooke Larson, what's your underplayed story?
Yeah, I wanted to share a story that Emily Anderson Stern wrote about a former enslaved person who was lynched on Capitol Hill here in Utah. And state leaders have been resisting a memorial, but Salt Lake City recently unveiled a plaque telling this man's story. So I think it's just important look into the history of this issue in Utah and how our elected officials have been approaching it.
All right, sltrib.com for that one. Leah Larson, what's your underplayed story?
So mine is by our colleague Andrew Christensen at the Times Independent Moab. So the Moab Arches shuttle is about to fire up and start taking passengers to the national parks there. It's been a controversial shuttle, but desert season is upon us, so I'm sure they're bracing for an influx of visitors. So I recommend checking out that story if you want to be one of those visitors and seeing when and how you can take the shuttle.
Okay, sltrib.com for that one. Well, we've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brooke Larson. Brooke, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you. And we've been talking with water and land use reporter Leah Larson. Leah, thank you.
Thank you. Enjoy the weekend.
Yeah, you too. Coming up following the break, we'll continue the conversation with investigative reporter Jessica Schreifels. Here's the headline: the aggravated murder case against the man accused of killing Charlie Kirk will move to trial And you are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. More following this. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We turn next to Salt Lake Tribune investigative reporter Jessica Schreifels. So, Jessica, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So here is the headline. The aggravated murder case against the man accused of killing Charlie Kirk will move to trial. So I guess there were a couple things decided here, right? The possibility of the death penalty and then I guess moving to trial.
Right. So it's a little bit complicated, but basically, we talked about this before. In July, he was in a probable cause hearing, and that was when prosecutors presented evidence that they say showed that Tyler Robinson was the person who shot and killed Charlie Kirk. And so at the end of this hearing, which was delayed to September, just earlier this week, the judge gets to decide whether there's probable cause for the case to move forward. And that is a really low bar. It's not, proof beyond a reasonable doubt, like they're looking for at a trial. It doesn't have any indication of guilt or anything like that. It just shows that that there was a crime likely committed and that the defendant was likely the person who did that crime. This process is intended to kind of ferret out meritless prosecutions. And so the bar is pretty low. And so now the case will move forward. But because one of the charges that he was bound over on is aggravated murder, he is continues to be eligible for the death penalty if he's convicted, which prosecutors said is something that they'll seek.
So the aggravating factor was up for debate here, right? Tell me about that.
Right. And so his defense team didn't really, attack the bulk of the evidence, which they said is not a concession of facts. The bar, as I said, is so low. So that's not the argument they wanted to be making at this time. And so what they focused on instead was the aggravating factor that makes this a death penalty eligible case. And that's that prosecutors say Robinson put others at a great risk of death when he, fired into a crowd and there were people very close by to where Charlie Kirk was. And so they were saying, he didn't hit anybody in the crowd. He didn't shoot at anybody else. He fired one bullet, allegedly, which hit the intended target. And so nobody else was at risk. And so that was the argument that the defense team was making. And the judge in his ruling, I think that he conceded that there could be merit to that argument. But at this stage, and given how he has to weigh the evidence and he has to make any inference in favor of the prosecution, he did decide to bind over the aggravated murder charge. And so that is what Tyler Robinson will face when he does go to trial.
So Utah County prosecutors laid out evidence. What are they presenting as evidence?
Yeah, so, they showed video surveillance evidence at UVU campus. There's DNA evidence that they say tied Tyler Robinson to the crime. And then he told a bunch of people, including his roommate and his roommate and romantic partner and some people that he talked with on Discord chats, that he was the one who did it. And basically what all this evidence showed is what prosecutors say is Tyler Robinson coming to UVU's campus on September 10th of last year, several times, kind of scoping out the area, changing his clothing and then hiding a rifle in his pants, going up to a campus building, laying on top of that roof, firing the fatal shot, and then running away and hiding that gun in a wooded area that was near campus. So that was kind of the case they were trying to build and used, as I mentioned, those types of evidence to try to prove that this was the right person.
What did Tyler Robinson's defense team say?
As I said, they didn't really dispute if he was the guy on the roof. And I don't think this was the time for them to do that. As I've mentioned, they mostly focused on the fact that they say he didn't put others at great risk of death when he fired that shot. And so that was kind of their primary argument. Also, they kind of try to poke holes in the DNA evidence and things like that. But primarily, it seemed to me that their main goal was to try to get the aggravating factor off the table, which, of course, they weren't successful at doing.
And the defense attorneys, they claim that Charlie Kirk spoke hatefully.
Yeah, so this is interesting. This gets into like it's when the prosecutors filed these charges, there were certain charges that they want enhanced because they say that Tyler Robinson chose Charlie Kirk as a victim because of his political beliefs. And the prosecutors argued, you know, Charlie Kirk was very famous for promoting traditional family values. He was opposed to gay marriage and transgender rights, and that really stood in opposition to Robinson, who was dating his roommate who was a man who was considering transitioning gender. So you know, these people are kind of at odds in their lifestyle. And one of Tyler Robinson's attorneys argued that, you know, there's not enough evidence to show exactly how Robinson felt about Kirk, but he did assert that Kirk spoke hatefully about gay people and those who were having sex outside of marriage, you know, not living the traditional family values. And that comment, you know, really drew quite a reaction from Kirk's family who were in the courtroom. Erica Kirk, you know, kind of started to cry, and later the family attorney came to the podium or whatnot, you know, I think it was like for our scheduling. They were asking about a scheduling or conference question, and he made a point to say, you know, Charlie was the opposite of hate, that he was leading a movement among young people, and that the person who showed hate was the person who assassinated him. So they took, it seemed to me, took like great offense to that suggestion that Charlie spoke hatefully about these groups.
What is next with, I guess, scheduling the trial? What's next?
Yeah, so in October, everyone comes back to court, and I think they will most likely set a trial date. There's a lot of moving pieces. You know, when you go to a trial, especially a death penalty trial, there's not really like surprise witnesses or things like that. Everything is kind of argued about beforehand. So they might have like a plan of, you know, we want to have arguments about what DNA evidence can be presented or what experts can testify before that, but we're hoping that in that October hearing that they'll set a trial date at least, and we'll see if it sticks.
Oh, I wonder if we could talk briefly about another story from this week. Here are the headlines. People are betting on the man accused of shooting Charlie Kirk. Here's what his attorneys say, why they say they're concerned. This, I think, has to do with the defense team trying to not have cameras in the courtroom.
Yeah, so this came from that same day on Tuesday when we were all in court. The court hearing got started a couple hours late because they were arguing behind closed doors about we well, at first we didn't know what. We didn't know what they were talking about. And then eventually, you know, the public and everyone was allowed in the courtroom, and the judge said that it was tied to the defense attorney's latest request to keep cameras out of the courtroom. He ruled against them that this should be kept private or, you know, secret. So we find out what this is. And what they wanted kept secret was that apparently people are betting on the gambling's website, Polymarket, on whether Tyler Robinson will be found guilty or not. And so they're saying if these cameras are in the courtroom, this could move markets or affect these online gambling, and it's, you know, commodifying a death penalty case, essentially.
So the judge was not convinced by this argument, apparently.
No, he wasn't. And you know, I would say almost every hearing we go to, it's been a year now, they ask for cameras to be taken out of the courtroom. And so a lot of his ruling was similar to every other ruling that he's had before. He does put really strict limitations on you know, the type of images that can be captured. Like, nobody can take photos of Tyler Robinson's, like the shackles that he wears. The TV camera has to be in a very wide shot. And so he puts a lot of limitations on the media already, and has yet to find that, you know, this Polymarket argument or any other argument so far is sufficient to close out or close the courtroom to cameras when there is a presumption of openness that cameras should be allowed.
By the way, you know the story that Polymarket users are betting on other high-profile cases, that Lindsey Clancy murder trial, for example.
Right, exactly. And I think I did this with my colleague Peyton Harkins. I think she found that also People are betting on Polymarca on whether Reckless Ben, that YouTuber, will be in jail by the end of the year. You know, he's been in Utah a couple times, filming this bricks and minifigs Lego resale saga. And he also like went undercover and posed as a teenager at Provo Canyon School. So there's also bets on whether this YouTuber will end up in jail.
Well, Jessica Schreifels, be continuing to cover this trial as it goes forward. Investigative reporter Jessica Schreifels, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And you've been listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Our thanks to everyone who's been on the program today. Investigative reporter Jessica Schreifels, water and land use reporter Leah Larson, reporter Brooke Larson. And thank you for listening. Hope you'll be with me again next time.